Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Alex Seitz-Wald, Salon.com's political reporter, who examines the factual context of the controversy surrounding inappropriate IRS scrutiny of Tea Party and conservative groups applying for nonprofit tax status. Timothy Carr of the media democracy group Free Press, who discusses growing opposition to the billionaire Koch brothers' bid to take over the Tribune Company that includes the Los Angeles Times and Chicago Tribune. And Bill Freese with the Center for Food Safety, who talks about the consequences for farmers and consumers resulting from Monsanto's recent Supreme Court victory upholding the company's patent on genetically modified soybean seeds. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Religious violence between Indonesia's Christians and Muslims arrived with a vengeance in the town Ambon in the late 1990s after the downfall of the Suharto dictatorship. Massive riots broke out in the Maluku Islands after centuries of calm since the Dutch colonized the region in the late 1600s. Traditional practices of mutual aid and a sense of common identity kept the peace until the downfall of Suharto in 1999. When the violence ended, more than 5,000 people had been killed and 500,000 people were driven from their homes. In the aftermath, moderate Christians and Muslims worked together to rebuild community ties as a group calling itself Peace Provocateurs. But today, Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch are criticizing Indonesian President Yudhoyono for not defending the rights of religious minorities. Recent incidents include Shia Muslims being driven out of their homes in East Java, and local officials in Bekasi, a suburb of Jakarta, demolishing a new Batak Protestant Christian church building after getting angry complaints from militant Islamists. When violence returned to Ambon in 2011, rioting destroyed 700 homes. The peace provocateurs sprang into action, requesting assistance and easing tensions by having Christian women stay in the homes of Muslim families. Canadian businessman Sarkis Yakubian sat in a Cuban jail for nearly 2 years after cooperating with prosecutors in a major corruption investigation. In April, prosecutors filed a 63-page indictment against the 53-year-old businessman, reflecting a new hard line against government corruption by Cuban President Raul Castro. He now faces a possible 12-year prison sentence. Yakubian, who runs a $30 million trading and transport company, blew the whistle when he told interrogators that he regularly bribed Cuban officials, handing over money to bureaucrats to secure contracts and to ensure they were honored after winning a bid. Prosecutors allege in their court filing that Yakubian or his employees bribed at least a dozen state officials with everything from nice dinners and prepaid phone cards to cash, $300 for a tip on a deal, $50,000 for a 2008 contract on earth movers. Yakubian disputes many of the details in the charges, but he says some foreign businessmen were bigger crooks than the Cubans, profiting unduly from shady business dealings, often, he says, with support or subsidies from Western governments. In early 2012, Yakubian's confessions were recorded on video and given to top Cuban officials, describing bribes and payoffs spreading like a cancer in the top rungs of the Castro regime. Mexican migrant Carolina Martinez traveled 2,000 miles to the U.S. to reunite with her husband in upstate New York. After arriving, she was hired to pick potatoes and onions and worked 6 and 7 days a week. Carolina says the crew manager subjected her to sexual harassment. She threatened to tell the boss, but realized complaining could get her fired and deported. Instead, she suffered in silence. Cheryl Gee, a sexual violence specialist at the Worker Justice Center in Rochester, New York, told the news magazine In These Times many female farm workers perceive rape and sexual harassment as part of coming here. They believe this is what they have to go through to feed their families. A 2010 survey published in the journal Violence Against Women reported upward of 80% of female farm workers were sexually harassed or assaulted on the job. Although undocumented workers currently have the legal right to file a sexual harassment complaint, few will go to the police out of fear of being deported. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
In recent weeks, the Obama administration has been battered by criticism over a trifecta of controversies or scandals, depending on your political perspective. They include questions about White House talking points in the aftermath of the September 11th attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya, that killed four Americans, the Justice Department's covert collection of Associated Press reporters' phone records in the course of investigating a government leak related to a foiled terrorist plot, and the Treasury Department admission that staffers at the Internal Revenue Service Cincinnati office had selected Tea Party and conservative groups for extra scrutiny of their 501c4 nonprofit status applications. A recent Treasury Department Inspector General's investigation into the IRS matter concluded that political bias did not play a role in the employees' use of inappropriate criteria as they attempted to identify groups that did not comply with 501c4 requirements that such organizations be primarily engaged in social welfare issues and not electoral politics. Despite the results of the IRS probe, which found the White House had no involvement in directing IRS handling of nonprofit applications, Republican politicians and Tea Party activists charged that the White House was complicit in targeting conservative groups, frequently comparing the episode to the Nixon-era Watergate scandal. One of the contributing factors in the IRS controversy revolves around the lack of clarity in tax regulations governing requirements to be awarded 501c4 status, compounded by the flood of groups, many on the right, that have made applications since the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision that opened the floodgates of unlimited and unaccountable money in U.S. election campaigns. Your reporter spoke with Alex Seitz-Wald, Salon.com's political reporter, who examines the factual context of the IRS controversy and the need for tax code and campaign finance reform.
So what happened here is that after Citizens United, there was this explosion of new groups filing under 501c4 of the tax code. 501c4 gives you a little bit more leeway to get involved in politics, but you're still supposed to be, your primary purpose is still supposed to be a social welfare organization. But there's kind of a loophole in that the IRS has never defined what that means, where you draw the line at primary purpose. So a lot of groups, both on the left and right, but especially on the right after Citizens United, formed under this tax code. And what it allows you to do is spend unlimited amounts of money and not disclose any of your donors. So it's natural that the IRS would want to go after these groups and kind of figure out which were genuine social welfare groups and which were political groups in disguise, you know, exploiting this tax loophole. What they did is they said, well, look at all these Tea Party groups forming. Let's flag, groups that have the words Tea Party or defend the Constitution or educate about American history, a few other keywords that are kind of associated with the conservative movement. They said, let's flag those for extra scrutiny because those are, you know, more likely than not going to be political groups instead of genuine social welfare groups. And that is wrong in that, you know, you can't single out any kind of group for scrutiny. And that certainly deserves merit. And I think the Inspector General's report from the Treasury Department, if you read it, is very fair and judicious and rightly criticizes the IRS for engaging in that behavior. But this is hardly the kind of, you know, Watergate level conspiracy theory that we're talking about. There's no indication that this rose to the White House. And indeed, it would be completely illegal for the White House to even be involved in kind of lower level functioning of the IRS, thanks to Watergate. After Nixon used the IRS to go after targets, there were laws created that made it very difficult. And there's only two political appointees in the entire IRS now in order to limit political meddling. So there's no way to tie this to the White House at all. This is sort of mid-level bureaucrats in the IRS doing this. And the more we learn about it, we learn that they went after liberal 501c4 groups as well, far fewer of them than Tea Party groups, but still several of them. So I don't see, at least from the information that we have available, I don't see any kind of political vendetta or any kind of systematic effort to target conservative groups for the sake of targeting conservative groups. I see mid-level bureaucrats given almost no direction on how they're supposed to do their job in determining what's a legitimate political group and what's a social welfare group, and doing the best they can in a poor way, and then, rightly getting in trouble for it. But this is much less sexy than I think the media is trying to make it.
There are many observers of this current controversy with the IRS who point to what they believe to be a more important scandal, and that's the IRS code itself in dire need of reform, along with our system of campaign money, which was, of course, exacerbated by the Supreme Court Citizens United decision, which opened the floodgates of unlimited and unaccountable money. There are people who are concerned, and you wrote a column about this, that this will have a chilling effect on any future scrutiny of groups on the right, particularly, but maybe any political group, and that whatever these organizations are doing in the name of their 501c4 status may be untouchable. What do you think?
Yeah, I think this is the real scandal here. And unfortunately, the dangerous fallout, which is, you know, as I mentioned earlier, the whole reason that this happened is because the IRS has never defined what makes you a social welfare group or what makes you a political group. That line desperately needs to be drawn. Now, with the IRS under so much scrutiny because of this, I think it's politically impossible. And you know, every campaign finance expert that I speak to says the same thing begrudgingly, and members of Congress on Capitol Hill say the same thing. There's just so much political pressure on the IRS now that they're not going to be able to draw that line. And if they do, they're going to come under so much scrutiny that it's either going to be incredibly weak or vague or, you know, possibly backtracked on. And, of course, Congress could pass a law, but that seems highly unlikely given that Republicans control the House and, you know, would probably use the filibuster to preserve the ability to spend anonymously in elections than they have in the past. So, unfortunately, you know, the best hope for resolving this small but important bit of the broken campaign finance system was getting the IRS to take action. And now it seems like that's going to be taken off the table for some time, at least until the scandal blows over. And even then, you know, the memory will be so strong of the scandal, and you can count on conservatives jumping on whatever the IRS does, because they're not going to like it. They like this, having this option of spending, you know, massive amounts of money anonymously through elections. So it's really unfortunate, but I don't see a way that we're going to, you know, close this loophole and draw that line between political and social welfare groups anytime soon.
That was Alex Seitz-Wald, Salon.com's political reporter. Find links to Wald's recent articles covering the IRS controversy by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Multi-billionaires Charles and David Koch make their money by exploiting fossil fuels. They've funded all manner of conservative and right-wing political efforts and candidates, including organizations and individuals who deny the reality of human-caused climate disruption. Now the brothers are setting their sights on buying some of the most influential newspapers in the country. The Kochs have expressed interest in the bankrupt Tribune Company, which is looking for a buyer for the 8 newspapers it owns: the Chicago Tribune, the Los Angeles Times, the Baltimore Sun, the Hartford Courant, and 4 others in Florida, Virginia, and Pennsylvania. According to news reports, the Koch brothers are top contenders to make the purchase, which could be consummated in the next few months. But that outcome is being opposed by a coalition of media activists, environmentalists, and grassroots community groups, all of whom see a Koch brothers' purchase of the Tribune Company as a disaster. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Timothy Carr, Senior Director of Strategy with Free Press, a media reform and pro-democracy organization that is one of several groups opposing a Koch brothers' takeover of the Tribune newspapers. Here he explains what's at stake in the Tribune deal and how people are coming together to try to stop the Koch's media grab.
I think the Tribune Company is in a pretty dire circumstances. They went through a bankruptcy proceeding recently, and the majority shareholders are now looking at ways that they can hand off the parts of the company that they think are the least profitable. The Tribune Company, people might know, well, not only publishes newspapers, it has 8 newspapers in fairly significant cities around the country, but it also is in the business of television broadcasting, which is much more profitable. And so they want to calve off, to separate those 8 newspapers and sell them for anywhere, and I've heard a number between $600 and $700 million.
Do you know if other entities are also interested in buying the Tribune papers?
Well, we only know what we've read in several media reports. The LA Weekly and the New York Times have reported that the Kochs are at the top of a fairly short list of prospective buyers of the Tribune Company newspapers. And there have been there's been interest expressed by a number of parties. In some cases, parties have wanted to just purchase one or two of the newspapers. There's a possible coalition of investors in Los Angeles that are interested in buying the Los Angeles Times, for example. But it's in the interest of the Tribune Company to sell all eight newspapers as a single package. And the only investor who has indicated, again, this is reporting to these news reports, the only investor has indicated interest in all eight papers are the Koch brothers through their company Koch Energy and Koch Enterprises.
Tim Carr, it's an interesting kind of coalition where you have some media activists and some political types who are opposed to a Koch buyout, and also a real grassroots element. You know, like there was a big demonstration of grassroots folks in Chicago who were saying that the Kochs taking over the Tribune would be really detrimental to their lives. Is that happening in other cities as well?
It has, and there have been recent protests in Los Angeles. There have been protests in Chicago. There is a national day of action that is scheduled to occur later this month on May 29th that will involve actions in cities across the country. While the Kochs are known for the specific brand of right-wing ideology, this is really about journalism. This is about what it is that a newspaper should represent for a community. And the problem that organizations like Free Press see with the Kochs is that they do have a track record of attacking journalism. They do have a track record of supporting organizations that have misled the public on key issues like the science of global warming, and that their intentions for owning these newspapers are not to better serve those communities, but to further spread some of this misinformation. And that's not good for journalism. They don't really have an interest in supporting the kind of hard-hitting local journalism that these communities need. And we have seen over the last several decades that thousands and thousands of journalists have lost their jobs, whether they're working in newspaper newsrooms or local television stations, and that the sort of ownership that we need right now are not individuals who hope to further decimate the news and undermine quality journalism, but people who are really from those communities and are willing to invest in keeping journalists on the job in addition to reporting on issues that are of concern to that community. You know, this is not just an argument about journalism, it's an argument about doing good business. Good business is serving your customers. And if your customers are readers in those communities, you need to put their needs first. And it's pretty clear from the readership of these communities that the Kochs political agenda doesn't align with their needs to get more local news and information that's willing to challenge powerful institutions, both corporations and powerful individuals in government.
Are people talking about a boycott to try to prevent the Kochs takeover? People saying, you know, we just won't buy these newspapers and therefore they would lose value and then might not be so desirable for the Kochs to even buy them.
Some of the groups that have been involved in the Koch protest include the Courage Campaign, which is based in California, and they have received thousands of pledges from people to unsubscribe from these newspapers should the ownership transfer to the Kochs. So, yes, there is a kind of preemptive boycott that is already taking place. And, you know, I think if it gets closer to a reality, we could also be looking at reaching out to some of the traditional advertisers for Tribune newspapers, whether they be the LA Times or the Chicago Tribune, and asking whether or not they would be willing to pull their ads as a way to protest this transfer of ownership.
That was Timothy Carr, Senior Director of Strategy with the media democracy group Free Press. For more information on growing opposition to the Koch brothers' takeover of the Tribune newspapers, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In a landmark case for the U.S. biotech industry, the Supreme Court ruled unanimously on May 13th that farmers were prohibited from using Monsanto's genetically engineered soybean seeds to grow and replicate new seeds without first paying the company a licensing fee. The case Bowman v. Monsanto pitted the biotech giant against Indiana farmer Vernon Hugh Bowman, who had purchased soybean seeds from the bottom of a grain elevator, planted those, and then used the seeds produced for a second crop. Monsanto sued Bowman for $84,000 for his use of those seeds, which are genetically engineered to be resistant to the company's own herbicide, Roundup. Writing for the court majority, Justice Elena Kagan ruled that Mr. Bowman had violated Monsanto's patent rights. 90% of soybeans now grown in the U.S. are the genetically modified Roundup Ready brand and sold by Monsanto. Critics are troubled that the precedent set in this case will enable large multinational corporations to enforce patents on a variety of new life forms used in medical applications such as vaccines and new food products like GE salmon. The power of biotech companies like Monsanto are quickly becoming the focus of public concern. This year's federal farm bill, which was passed by Congress in March and signed into law by President Obama, includes a provision known as the Monsanto Protection Act that prevents courts from enforcing rulings restricting the sale of genetically modified food crop seeds. On the consumer front, many states are responding to grassroots campaigns demanding the establishment of new laws that mandate the labeling of GMO food products. Your reporter spoke with Bill Fries, science policy analyst with the Center for Food Safety, who talks about the significance of Monsanto's recent Supreme Court victory and state initiatives to mandate the labeling of GMO foods.
We were quite disappointed with the decision, and I think it's useful to put it in the context of, you know, kind of the broader issues with patents on crop varieties and seeds. In 2005, we did a report called Monsanto versus U.S. Farmers, and basically we looked at the law and we interviewed a lot of farmers who had been pursued legally by Monsanto for potentially or allegedly saving seeds that had been patented by the company. And as you said, most of these cases have revolved around Roundup Ready soybeans. You know, we've had a long history in agriculture of farmers saving seeds from their harvest for replanting the next season. And, you know, this practice is as old as agriculture. And with the rise of patents on seeds, since the 1990s, companies have gained the power to prevent farmers from doing that. And it's considered now a form of patent infringement to do something as simple and basic as, you know, planting seeds from your harvest for the next season. And what we've done is we've cataloged all of the cases, and Monsanto has pursued thousands of farmers for this newfound crime of seed saving and collected tens of millions of dollars from them. And Hugh Bowman's case is just kind of the most recent example of this.
Beyond this case, what are the larger issues in your view of for-profit corporations patenting various forms of life? Because that seems to be filled with a lot of hazard as we go down the path to the future and what more sophisticated technology might bring us in terms of foods or other new organisms.
Yeah, I think it's really, you know, a negative development. The whole purpose of patents is supposedly to spur innovation that's in the public interest. And yet what we've seen with patents on seeds in particular, there have been, you know, reduced offerings of affordable seeds for farmers. And the companies that now control the seed supply, if you look at the statistics, it's like five of the large biotechnology companies, Monsanto, Dow, Syngenta, DuPont, and Bayer. These five companies control about 58% of commercial seed sales. And what they're most interested in doing with genetic engineering is making crops resistant to herbicides that they also sell. So that's getting to be all that you can find now in seed supply in the United States. It's led to substantial increases in herbicide use, much higher, you know, rates of resistant weed evolution, and again, kind of a narrowing of seed options for farmers, and particularly the conventional seeds that are more affordable and that a lot of farmers would like to plant if they could find them. So I think it's really unfortunate, this idea that, you know, when you see how patents have been used by these very powerful companies, again, to restrict seed options, increase seed prices, and channel what innovation there is into these negative directions of increasing the use of toxic herbicides.
Bill, I wanted to ask you about the whole issue of labeling that's come to the fore in recent years. Many states now are pursuing mandatory labeling of genetically engineered foods in the supermarkets. Tell us, if you would, about these efforts and Monsanto's recent efforts to lobby the federal government to prohibit states from requiring labeling of genetically engineered products.
Yeah, it's been really interesting. In California, I think there was a major effort to get an initiative to label genetically engineered foods in the state of California, and it became very close to passing. And the only reason it didn't pass was because Monsanto and other big companies put in nearly $50 million in advertising to kind of cloud the issues and put out a lot of false messages, just before the vote. Since that time, as you said, a lot of other states, instead of just kind of lying down and saying, oh, well, no chance, they've taken just the opposite approach and said, no, we have to have, labeling. And, there have actually been, in this year, 53 bills introduced in 26 states to label GM foods, which I think is a really good sign of how strong the movement to put the brakes on these crops is. It's really heartening to see that. And I just hope that we can finally get the FDA to see reason here. And, what's interesting in this case, too, is if you look internationally, the United States is the exception among developed countries on this issue. 64 countries, both developed and developing, have mandatory genetically engineered food labeling. So the United States is really the outlier here, and we need to move on this.
That was Bill Fries, science policy analyst with the Center for Food Safety. Learn more about grassroots challenges to the biotech industry and GMO foods by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.